get lost during the week. LOST45.com.
It's time to find the Lost 45.
Hi, it's Barry Scott with another edition of Lost 45 Conversations, the podcast companion to our long-running retro music show, The Lost 45s, heard on radio stations all over the world and at lost45.com. Thank you for listening. With our library of over 1,000 exclusive artist interviews, there are plenty of shows to come. This week, our guest is a guy with 11 top 40 hits as an artist. He also wrote quite a few for others. He's well known for iconic albums like Tea for the Tillerman, Teaser and the Firecat, and Catch Bullet 4. We secured his first American interview in 30 years by way of Dolly Parton. They're close friends, and she recommended me to his agent. Sometimes it is who you know. We'll chat about his name, the hits, a near-death experience, and his spiritual quest that led to his Yusuf Islam name change, among other things. Let's get right to the artist known as Cat Stevens.
Hello.
Hello, I'm looking for Yusuf.
Yusuf.
This is Barry in Boston. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can.
Okay. It's kind of like This Is Your Life.
Oh.
So it'll have a little Steven, a little Cat, a little Yusuf. Since you've had a few lives, kind of like a cat, we have to start from the beginning.
Okay, all right. I'm ready.
Okay. I know you were born Steven in London in 1948, Greek dad, Swedish mom, and your parents owned a restaurant called Moulin Rouge. I wanted to find out if you worked there as a child.
I did work there. In fact, I was quite a successful young waiter at the age of about 10. That's where I first learned how to serve the public, if you like. And I was highly rewarded with a lot of tips. That's kind of my beginning. That's where I began.
I did tons of research on you, Yusuf, so you'll be amazed at some of the stuff I'm going to come up with.
Okay.
You studied folk music at Hammersmith Art School about 1966, and you met record producer Mike Hurst, formerly of the Springfields, who produced your first disc, I Love My Dog. Tell listeners how you became Cat Stevens. I read a girlfriend thought you had eyes like a cat.
Yeah, that's one of the background stories. And the other one was that, in fact, at that time, there were about three or four things that caught my attention. One was a film called What's New, Pussycat? Another was a film called Cat Ballou. And then there was a record, which I loved, by Norma Taniga called Walking My Cat Named Dog. All these things combined with, you know, my girlfriend sort of making that comment gave me the idea.
I thought I was the only one who knew the Norma Taniga song.
Oh, right. No, it was a great song. I loved it. And Walking My Cat Named Dog. And then there was, of course, Walking the Dog by Rufus Thomas.
Well, it also signifies someone who has a bunch of musical lives. So I guess it works well.
Yeah.
I Love My Dog and Matthew and Son charted over in England in 66 and 67 from the Matthew and Son album. From what I read from Rolling Stone magazines, you were kind of billed as a teen idol. Was that strange for you?
It wasn't exactly the kind of direction I wanted to go, because originally I was extremely influenced by musicals. I was living in the West End, just around the corner from Drury Lane, where all the theatres are, you know. And so I used to love musicals and theatre. So my first ambition was actually to become a composer of musicals. But in the end, the songs that I wrote were kind of different in that way, because I was always telling a story. But then nobody was going to have any confidence putting on a musical with my music. So I had to earn my status, first of all, as a songwriter. And then that was easy to do as a singer. So I just put on a black velvet suit, you know, from Carnaby Street, and a white frilly shirt, and Bob's your uncle, you've got a pop star.
I know other artists had hits with your songs. In 1967, P.P. Arnold had a hit with First Cut Is the Deepest over in England. And the Tremolos, Here Comes My Baby, was your first big success here in America as a songwriter. And I wanted to know, at that time, did you think about becoming a songwriter and not a performer?
The original idea was to be a composer and a songwriter. I loved what the Beatles were doing. I loved what Burt Bacharach was doing, you know, and I loved what Goffin King were doing and Motown. But I had my own quirky little songs, and it seemed that nobody wanted to sing them except me. There was one or two, like, as you say, the Tremolos did one, P.P. Arnold did one, but I was the only one who could really sing the majority of my catalogue. So it ended up me doing it.
I read you toured with Engelbert Humperdinck and Jimi Hendrix at different times. If you closed your eyes right now, what do you remember about any of those tours?
Well, it was kind of fast, and it was, you know, it's a blur, actually. That's what I remember. When you start these tours, you know, they're very intense. Once you're rolling, you don't see the light of day until it finishes, you know. And we were going all over the country doing two shows a night. There was Engelbert Humperdinck, Jimi Hendrix, and the Walker Brothers, and me. You know, it was just an amazing tour, of course, and I learned a lot of things. I learned the life of the road. That actually contributed to my downfall, I think, and my contracting tuberculosis very soon in my pop star career. So I think I overdid it.
After I'm Gonna Get Me a Gun, which was a top 10 hit in the UK, A Bad Night in Kitty, all in 1967. You came down with TB about 19, I think you were, and spent about a year recuperating. Did that give you time to think and regroup?
Yeah, that was my moment of reflection. And, you know, I was certainly alone to think, and I had enough time and space to really evaluate where I was going and what I wanted to do. And in a way, that was the beginning of the exploration of Eastern religions and, you know, Buddhism and Maharishi and, you know, all those kind of exotic spiritual paths. I was looking into Buddhism particularly. And that began, if you like, my real earnest search for some big answers, because I was probably close to death, you know, and there was very serious illness at that time. Though they had the medicines, you know, I was very late in diagnosing this thing. So that began my spiritual search. In a way.
I wanted to pretend you were on a psychiatrist's couch, and I'm just going to give you a song title and say whatever pops into mind about it. Ready?
Okay.
The first one is Hard-Headed Woman.
Sound of Music.
Explain that one.
It's a long story, but there's some chords I was playing from The Sound of Music, and I kind of developed the song from that, and then I wrote the song Hard-Headed Woman. By the way, I never heard Elvis Presley's version of that song, this song called Hard-Headed Woman.
They didn't try to sue you, did they?
No, not at all. Very kind.
That's good. Yeah, they are two separate songs, that's for sure. Anything that pops into your mind about father and son?
The Russian Revolution. That was one of the songs that I wrote after my tuberculosis spell, and I was getting better, and I was writing again, and I began looking at musicals. Again, I wanted to write a musical. So I met a manager and we came up with this idea about writing about the Russian Revolution, a story about the history of Nicholas and Alexander against the story of a family, a very poor family, you know, from the rural areas of Russia. It was a story about a son who wanted to join the revolution and the father who wanted to just keep things as they were and work on the land.
So unlike sources like Billboard magazine, it isn't entirely autobiographical.
No, I mean, there's obviously parts of experience from your own life, you take ideas and inspiration, but at the same time, when you're writing a musical, you can project yourself, you can project all kinds of characters into your story, and that's how I wrote that song.
The first song that introduced you to America was Wild World, the first hit here in 71. Well, do you think that was a good song for an introduction?
Probably, because, you know, it's still as wild today as it ever was, and I think that it's extremely relevant, probably one of my most profound lyrics, because it stands up absolutely today as well.
Do you think that that's why it broke through here? It was so easily identifiable?
I'm not sure, but it was probably the only very memorable refrain. One of the songs that had a catchy kind of chorus thing, whereas most of my songs don't normally fall into that kind of hit formula category.
I want to take a segue to a movie, Harold and Maude in 71. You wrote a lot of songs for it. Ruth Gordon and Bud Cort were in it. Became a cult hit. One of the songs that always sticks out in my mind, if you want to sing out, sing out.
Yeah, that was a great song. I think I wrote that song in Jamaica at one time. I was just kind of playing around there, got that thing. And then I was asked to write some new songs. We got involved with this film, you know, Harold and Maude. And they wanted a couple of new songs. And I had this one unfinished. I finished it and I wrote it and recorded it in San Francisco in Wally Hyder Studios there. And then I kind of gave it to them immediately. And they used that for the film. And I didn't want them to use that because I wanted to get back in the studio and do it properly. But, you know, it never got the chance. And so it ended up very rough in that raw state going into the film.
It's a most unusual film.
That's a great film.
Teaser and the Firecat came next late in 71. I wanted to talk about Morning Has Broken. I know Rick Wakeman of Yes was on piano and that it was based on a Christian hymn, I think, written in 1931. How was it found?
That was me looking and searching for ideas during probably a dry patch in my writing career. And I was just wanting to get some more ideas. And I suppose that then I went into a bookshop and I found this religious department and I walked up to the hymn section, you know, and I pulled out a book. And I bought it just to take it home and start looking for inspiration. I found this song and I played it one finger style. I can't really read music. And I said, wow, this is a beautiful song. I never sang it at school, but apparently a lot of people did. And when I brought it out again, people said, well, we used to sing that at school, you know. And Rick Wakeman was fantastic. He played the piano, but we couldn't put his name on the album because he was contracted to another label at that time. In those days, you couldn't do that kind of thing. So we had to keep it secret.
Another tune from Teaser and the Firecat, Moonshadow.
Well, Moonshadow was really a very naive discovery of mine when I was out in Spain having a holiday. I was on the rocks one moonlit night. Do you know, I'm a city boy, so I never really got the chance to see the moon alone without a lamp or a street light next to it. So when you see the moon, you know, on its own in the open of nature, then you realize you look down, you see you've got a shadow. And I couldn't believe that I had a moon shadow. And that was like a great discovery for me. And I wrote the song based on that.
One of the biggest songs you're known for here in America and obviously all over the world was Peace Train. And I wanted to find out if you remember the exact moment that title came to your mind.
No. No, it'd be difficult to actually remember that. But I do know that I was on the road. I was trying to record that song for Tea for the Tillamat because I'd had it around. I had these chords. It was kind of like a Greek sort of melody which I'd had. I don't know how I got the peace train. It may have been because I was traveling up sometimes on trains, you know, doing gigs. Maybe that's where I got the idea. And of course, peace was one of the main anthems that we were singing about and we wanted desperately to talk about at that time during the Vietnam War, etc. So that's how I got to write that song. But this little Greek sort of riff, you know, I had going for some time, but it never ended up being on Tea for the Tillamat. It ended up on Tears in the Firecat.
Doing the research on you, one of the things I found most interesting and I did not know, it said that you briefly dated Carly Simon, who's been a guest a few times on my show, and that she wrote some songs about you, including Anticipation, and you wrote Sweet Scarlet supposedly about her.
Yeah, as long as my wife isn't listening, I can say that yes, we did. We did, you know, write a couple of songs about each other, and yes, the song I wrote was called Sweet Scarlet.
She's absolutely, having talked to her a few times, a very intelligent, beautiful woman.
Yeah, and she recently recorded a track called Into White when she did some memorable songs that she wanted to do from her loved songs catalog, whatever, and that was one of my songs too.
As long as she didn't write You're So Vain About You, I think you're okay.
Probably.
Oh, I don't think so.
Anyway, vanity has gone down the drain these days.
I was 9 years old when Catch Bullet 4 came out, and one of the first songs I remember buying as a 45 was Sitting, and I found the words as a 9-year-old profound, and now as an adult I still find them profound. Tell listeners anything you can about Sitting.
Sitting, I think, is a very important song. It's one of my milestone songs. You know, consider certain songs that took you to a new direction. And that really, for me, it's still absolutely relative. I can relate to it. And, you know, it talks about a mirror of my meditative years, you know, when I was sitting. But I wasn't stationary. I was moving. It was kind of like more of a spiritual direction that I was going into. And so really, the song is paradox, you know, because it talks about sitting, but it really talks about moving. And you can do that while you're sitting, by the way. So that's the whole point, is that what we do with our lives, sometimes we should sit down and think about it, and we might sort some things out.
I remember as a 9-year-old, I even found the lyrics at that time biblical.
Yeah, and they were kind of almost, they had a sense of premonition. Whatever door you open, you know, you're opening it from the same side every time. So you end up really where you are. It's important that when you look at life itself, you know, when they asked Noah, who lived, by the way, 900 years, in the Bible it mentions that. But, you know, when he was asked, what was life? He said, it's like going into a house in one door and then coming out the other. And that's an amazing, profound statement.
Another tune from Catch Bullet 4. And this one was a hit over in England and in Europe. For some reason, this was not a hit here in America. I'm not sure it was even released. Can't Keep It In.
Yeah, Can't Keep It In was I think it was one of my sort of up songs, and it was almost part of my Buddy Holly-esque thing, you know, where you got three chords and you just, you know, and that's it. Can't Keep It In. It's a great message, actually. It's a song about, you know, again, it's got the peace message, the message of happiness for everybody in this world, and hoping to share some of the love and the things that I've received and passing them on somehow. And love is the biggest thing that you can give.
One thing about Can't Keep It In, it's very angst-filled.
Yeah, it's got angst about it. At that time, probably I was getting edgy because I was become bigger. Every record was like getting more and more attention, and I was a superstar or launched into that status at that point. And I was getting a little bit angry with, I suppose, the business. It was just getting too heavy, and I suppose it made me a little bit hard-edged, a little bit.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Get lost during the week. LOST45.com. What is the Lost 45s during the week? The answer, Lost45.com. LOST45.com.
The Lost 45s with Barry Scott.
It just doesn't get better than this, does it?
The next album in 73 was Foreigner, and it was a bit more introspective. One of my favorite top 40 hits, and I actually think it's an unlikely top 40 hit here in America, was The Hurt.
Yeah, so it was a weird song, you know. I went through a kind of period where I wanted to, in a way, remove myself slightly or turn myself into a stranger again. Hence, you know, you get the title The Foreigner. And I wanted to remove myself from my superstar status and just get back to some very ordinary songs, slightly bluesy, because I used to love the blues and the rhythm and blues and whatever. And I just got into that kind of record for my own enjoyment and to give me a holiday. And I did record that, by the way, in Jamaica.
It doesn't sound like the lyrics from The Hurt are much of a holiday, though.
No, it's a fell was having a pretty bad time dealing with the business and, you know, becoming that kind of size and status. It was difficult to keep your balance. So I was feeling hurt. I was feeling hurt, really, because I was maybe getting out of touch with myself, possibly. And that's painful.
The next album was Buddha and the Chocolate Box in 74. Can you tell listeners where the album title came from?
With me waiting for a plane one day, I think one of these short flights between states or something, and I had with me a chocolate box and a Buddha. Both were in my hands, and I thought, wow, suppose the plane went down. Where would I be between the Buddha and the chocolate box? And so that was... But mind you, I mean, the song that I wrote on the album about Buddha actually is called Jesus. So I was deeply into spiritual questioning and searching.
I want to cover a couple songs on Buddha and the Chocolate Box. One of them, I think, is an unlikely, quote, Cat Stevens, unquote, number, in that it's just so fun, pop, and almost dancey. And I wondered how Ready came to you.
I think it was just I had these chords and I decided to finish the song, but it was never one of my favorite songs, but it ended up on the album, but never really one of my favorites.
It does sound a bit un-Cat Stevens-like.
Yeah, I think I was maybe experimenting to keep my own interest in writing the song. I just made it sound slightly different from my normal songs.
I hate to say it, but it could probably be remixed today by a dance artist and become a dance hit.
Probably, but you know, one of the hallmarks of my songs is that when they were played on the radio or whatever, or in the disco or whatever, people would normally sit down and start pondering. That's not a bad thing.
One of the songs to ponder, Oh Very Young.
It's, I think, a very important song, and it talks about what we're talking about today, which is, you know, how are we going to leave, how are we going to deal with the fact that we're polluting and destroying this earth that we live on. We're not really thinking about the future generation. And the question in this song is asked of the future generation, what are they going to leave their generation? So it's a very, very important futuristic song about this earth and looking after it through the young and through teaching the young how to behave.
By 1975, the artist that was a superstar known as Cat Stevens, The Greatest Hits, came out, and you did a rare remake of Sam Cooke's Another Saturday Night. I wanted to find out why the remake, and were you a Sam Cooke fan?
Yeah, I was a real Sam Cooke fan. I think it was one of those first jukeboxes that you could see the picture, the little video film of the artist performing it, and I think it was Charlie Checker, and there was Sam Cooke, and a few other artists. That was one of my favorites, and I just kept on putting shillings into the jukebox and playing that thing over and over again, so I loved it from my childhood, sort of younger years.
Your version certainly has a bit more pep to it, I gotta say.
Yeah, we recorded it in Japan.
I think that one rocks, and it holds up well today.
Yeah, no, this song is great. It's a great song.
I could almost picture your face if I mention the next song. I think it's a straight, unabashed love song, but maybe I missed something. Two Fine People.
Yeah, Two Fine People I did. It was a strange song. Again, I had two melodies, and I think probably it could have been two different songs, but I put them together. I think it was my manager's brother who came up with the idea of the title, Two Fine People. We were talking about marriage, and somehow this phrase came up, two fine people should love each other, and that's how I got the chorus.
I read in 1975 you almost drowned in Malibu, California at a beach, and at that point, more of a spiritual journey began for you. Can you tell listeners about that?
You know, that was at the point where after I'd done everything I wanted to kind of do in the musical sense, and yet I was still writing songs, still making records, because I had contracts to do so. My interest was leaning elsewhere. I was still on the spiritual search. What happened? I went out to my record chief's bungalow there in Malibu, Jerry Moss of A&M Records, went out for a swim that day. Now, you see, nobody really tells you not to go in, but I really couldn't take the current that day, and I was in serious trouble. I was drifting out to sea, and I couldn't get back to shore. And at that point, my inner belief in a higher power, looking at us and watching us, and in times of disaster, you know, helping us. And I called out. I said, God, if you help me, I'll work for you. I made a serious commitment. If I was to survive this thing, I would dedicate myself to the one who saves me. At that point, you know, a wave came from behind me, and then I had all the energy I needed, and seemed that the tide had turned, and I was back on land. And this was like a miracle. And for me, it was a commitment, an inner decision that I'd made. Then I had to wait for the next message to come.
Well, let's talk about one last song that was a big part of my childhood, and I find it joyous today. Remember the Days of the Old School Yard.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite songs, actually. And for me, it just reminds me of my school days in London, just around the corner from Drury Lane, in this little kind of school in an alley there with the playground that was actually in the basement. They had a kind of roof playground as well, but that was for the older people. And that time I was in primary school. So it's that memory of that time and those little fantasies that you have about maybe some sweethearts that may be in the same class as you. It's amazing because most of the songs that you've mentioned today, a lot of them are actually in this musical that I'm writing. So I think it's going to be very interesting for a lot of people people have got my music as part of their soundtrack to life, to actually experience and appreciate what I'm doing today, which is weaving many of those songs together as a story in a new musical called Moonshadow. And that's what actually I'm doing right now. I'm in the rehearsal rooms and we're just kind of finished for the day. So I hope that at some point it'll see the shores of the States and you'll be able to appreciate it.
Yusuf Islam Cat Stevens talks about a message on the liner notes of one of his later CDs, only on the Lost 45 Conversations.
There was a piece in there written by you that I absolutely love. And matter of fact, I loved it so much, it now hangs above my desk. And you wrote, "I don't think that God sent us prophets and books to fight about these books and these prophets, but they were telling us actually how to live together." And I wanted you to talk to American listeners most especially about that particular statement and about the fact that you are a man of peace.
Yeah, it's a very important statement, and it actually concisely tells you what I believe. A lot of people learn things from what others say about others, things which they really haven't studied themselves. My story is interesting because I did study different religions, and I came to Islam while I was still fairly young, you know, about 29, but I had studied all the other religions before that. To me, what struck me was this universality, this message of one God for all people, and that all prophets were actually belonging to the same religion. Ultimately, because I'd made that commitment deep down, I suddenly realized that this was the way I had to go. I had to change myself. I had to stop going down that path of probably destruction. Because, you know, most pop stars, if you leave them to their own resources, you know, would definitely not be guided. You need a guide. You need to submit yourself to a higher power. And to me, God was the only one to submit to. And Islam was so clear in that regard. Then I realized that that was what I had to do. But that was before, of course, all the bad news hit the papers about the political side of the Muslim world and what's going on here, there, and everywhere, and so many sort of distortions of that pure message. And then I had to deal with that, which was very difficult. And of course, it still is very, very difficult. But I'm hoping that, you know, when people stop listening to others and start actually making research themselves, they might find a different picture from the one that they're given. That's the point.
I know that you don't do very many interviews, and I'm honored that you are doing this one. But when I spoke to a few people in radio about this, they actually had a couple thoughts. The Salman Rushdie controversy, and I worked at a classic rock station and they pulled his music off the air. And I said, that can't be. He's a man of peace. I am sure his statements were taken out of context.
Yeah, I mean, that was something, again, which I learned the hard way. And that is, no matter where you are, especially if you appear to be coming from a direction which people are not familiar with or which they've already got a prejudice about, and then they want to get you to fit their little box. There I was asked about a very, very hot and very controversial subject. I wasn't making any judgments, but I was just saying, like the Bible, the punishment for blasphemy is death, and that's as simple as that. I just was quoting verse and chapter, but I wasn't actually saying that I supported the fatwa, and in fact, I never did support the fatwa. That was the point. And I think it was made to look as if my statement in saying, it says this in the Bible, it says this in the Quran, that was in support of the fatwa. That's the way the press spins it. Ever since I've had to answer that issue, it means people looking into what was actually said, and all my statements are on my website. If they want to find out, they can read it. It's not quite the Cat Stevens that was there 30 years ago, but in a way, it's the same heart and the same inspiration that's driving me.
I wanted to find out if you had any message to American fans who are listening.
Well, my message is the one which first gave me my inspiration. I think that love is the greatest inspiration, and music somehow binds people and brings people together.
Do you see the American Rock and Roll Hall of Fame ahead of you, or is that too political here?
I don't really worry about that, although I do believe that when it comes to in-flight lists of 100 top 10 albums, I think that Teeth of the Tin Man should be there.
And I think it is.
Yeah.
Yusuf Islam Cat Stevens, our guest on the Lost 45 Conversations. We have over 900 exclusive artist interviews, so stay tuned for another podcast. For more information on the weekly and daily music shows, go to Lost45.com. That's Lost45.com. Spread the word, and thank you so much for listening. Lost 45.
May tomorrow be a perfect day.
May you find love and laughter along the way.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thanks for listening to The Lost 45s, America's largest music and interview library. Visit our website for all things Lost, lost45.com. That's L-O-S-T, the number 4, the number 5.com. The Lost 45s is a federal trademark. No use of the term or rebroadcast of the show is allowed. The Lost 45s is created weekly by Get Lost Productions. This is Barry Scott. Thanks for listening to The Lost 45s, records you never thought you'd hear again. Tell everyone you know about the show. Until next time, get lost. Lost.